Kevin Dwayne Harvey in Commonwealth, Virginia.
Good afternoon, judges. My name is Gary Elder. I'm from Charlotte County, Virginia, and I represent Tevin Dwayne Harvey on an appeal from the circuit court in Mecklenburg County. And what I am asking the court to do in this case...
Would you like any rebuttal time, sir?
Yes, please. 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. And what I'm asking the court to do in this case is to reverse the sentence that was imposed in the Mecklenburg Circuit Court and remand the case for resentencing in that court.
Can you help me with something as a threshold matter?
Yes.
I see the objections on appendix pages 34 and 38. And they're basically about a sentence or two. Is there anything else that sets forth the contention that you raise on appeal, namely that the specific terms of the statute were violated?
No, Your Honor. And I know that the Commonwealth has raised that issue in its brief. My contention is that the objections that I made to the testimony of Janet Stewart and Heather Brown were understood by the court. Basically, what I was objecting to was the introduction of evidence that went beyond the impact of what had taken place. I think from the record it appears that Judge Osborne understood my objection, and the basis for the appeal, quite frankly, is that the first time I made the objection, it was sustained by Judge Osborne, and then on the very next victim, the same objection was overruled. Basically, the crux of the appeal is that the court allowed testimony that extends beyond what is permissible under the Virginia Code, specifically Section 19.2-295.3, which holds that the court shall limit the victim's testimony to the factors set forth in Clauses 1 through 6 of Subsection A of Virginia Code 19.2-299.1. And those six factors are enumerated in the code. They allow for identification of the victim, identification of any economic loss suffered, the nature and extent of any physical or psychological injury suffered, any changes in the victim's personal welfare, lifestyle, or familial relationships, requests for psychological or medical services initiated, or such other information as the court may require related to the impact of the offense.
Counsel, and that's a very good recitation of the applicable statute and how that statute is supposed to be administered. But in this case, how would it have been possible for the victim in the case to testify as to how something affected her if she wasn't able to provide some baseline or foundation as to what the situation was? In other words, I could get up and say, I am, you know, heartbroken, I'm suffering from sleepless nights, I broke out in hives, I've had all these things happen to me, and a fact finder could say, well, maybe you have a medical condition that causes you to do those things, without some background, for instance, saying, before this, I slept well, I never broke out in hives, I've never been nervous about things, but because of the specific circumstances that occurred here, now I have these circumstances.
I think I understand your question. I believe that in a standard sentencing hearing, at least those that I've been a part of, the questions are usually tailored to, you know, perhaps the Commonwealth might preface a question by saying, as a result of the break-in into your home on November 5th, 2013, can you describe how those events have affected you since? And the Commonwealth can, I think, get that evidence in. The problem that I have and the basis for the appeal in this case is essentially this: there was no trial in this case. Mr. Harvey
entered
a guilty plea and stipulated that the evidence that was proffered by the Commonwealth was sufficient to sustain his conviction. The problem is when you get to a sentencing hearing, you're dealing, the statute is actually referred to as the victim impact testimony statute. If you allow the Commonwealth to reintroduce, perhaps through new, perhaps even new evidence, but certainly through a new voice for the court to hear, what took place on that date, you're essentially turning a sentencing hearing into almost a new trial. And at that point, I'll give the court an example. There was evidence that came in through the victim testimony that I was not expecting to hear, that my client was not expecting to hear, and that I think he would have classified as untrue. Had that evidence been put forth during the guilt phase, I perhaps could have called, I probably would have had people subpoenaed who perhaps could have rebutted some of that testimony. But once we get to a sentencing phase, I'm in no position to do that, or my client is in no position.
But the cases also talk about the ability of a sentencing judge as opposed to a sentencing jury to differentiate between those things that are appropriately considered and those things that are not appropriately considered, and basically says that a trial judge, knowing the law, is able to work his way or her way through the idiosyncratic aspects of a sentencing hearing. Isn't that the check and balance that we have? If there's something that comes out that really should not be part of the deliberative process by a jury, the judge can sort of sort through that and do what he needs to do as she needs to do.
Yes, sir. I think that's very possible. However, what makes this case somewhat unique and somewhat strange is that the judge hearing the sentencing seemed to concede that the objection was properly made as to one victim. I believe the judge actually stated that we could hear evidence of the impact on that victim, but not
specifics
as to the events. And then on the very next victim, the exact same objection is made, and that objection is overruled. So it seemed that the trial judge was well aware of what typically comes in and somewhat reversed course during the hearing.
Does the catch-all number six, does that come into play? I mean, because you have some that are very specific, psychological, medical services, itemized economic loss, and you have this pretty broad factor right at the end that says such other information as the court may require related to the impact of the offense upon the victim.
That does seem to in some way be a catch-all provision. However, the sixth provision of 19.2-299.1 actually states, provide such other information as the court may require related to the impact of the offense on the victim. And everything seems to be geared toward that one specific word. It's the impact. It's not seeking a description of what actually occurred, because that's reserved for the guilt phase. And we had already surpassed that. And so I would argue that...
Of course, if we're going to have the victims doing this, then we're going to give the defendant his fair shake. Well, then we got to open that up to combat that. And so then...
And Judge, that's part of my contention, is that if the victim can take the stand and basically walk the court once again through the events that transpired, then I believe the defendant would probably be entitled to present his version, and then you're basically obviating the need for a guilt phase and a sentencing phase.
At a minimum, you increase the length and complexity of sentencing hearings.
Yes, sir. You're basically turning the sentencing phase almost into a new trial after the defendant has already been found guilty.
But, I mean, if part of the difficulty, though, and I see that danger, but if the victim says, well, I'm having trouble sleeping and all that, but, I mean, it's one thing if the defendant, you know, opened the door and was drunk and staggered in, realized he was in the wrong house and left, as opposed to some really horrific attack or whatever. So it's kind of hard to cabin the victim's testimony to just, I'm having these nightmares and I'm having counseling or whatever, completely divorced from what they went through. I mean, that's the difficulty I'm seeing.
I would tend to agree that at any sentencing hearing, I think the court is likely to grant a victim a little bit of leeway in giving a touch of background information. Here's why I can't sleep. But this case differs from your standard sentencing hearing, and that basically there was an extended period of testimony that had nothing to do with victim impact. It was essentially a fairly prolonged period of time where the victim simply said, here's what happened. There were no questions during that period of how did this impact you. There was no testimony regarding impact. It was just straightforward testimony as to the events that took place.
So the rest of your time for rebuttal?
That would be fine, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Judge.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Judge on behalf of the Commonwealth. With regard to the default, as the court's aware, we noted on brief that neither of the statutes were ever mentioned during the trial proceedings at all.
But the particulars of the concern were mentioned, wouldn't you agree?
I'm sorry?
The particulars of the concern, without saying I'm referring to X statute,
yes.
The particulars of the concern were indeed mentioned.
And the comment about a victim not being able to testify about the facts, I guess, would be the only thing that you could arguably say was preserved, but that's not the assignment of error that the defendant presented to the court. The assignment of error presented to the court was violation of both of those statutes. And it's clear that he never objected at any point in time to any testimony or pointed out what testimony he was relating to with regard to non-pros defenses,
but
which is the second assignment
but
of error.
The appendix at page 38, appellate's rejection specifically stated, quote, we've entered guilty pleas, we've stipulated. I think the Commonwealth has liberty to ask how those events have affected folks, but, and then the trial court cut him off.
Correct, and the trial court's ruling clearly indicates the trial court understands what's important in a sentencing hearing. And one of the problems I think the defendant's position is that the defendant's position is that the victim impact statutes are some kind of limitation on what evidence can be adduced from a victim during a sentencing proceeding, and that's not what they are at all. The victim impact statutes provide for the admissibility of such evidence. In 1991, the U.S. Supreme Court issued the opinion in Payne. Up until that point in time, there was great dispute as to whether this type of evidence was ever relevant in any way, shape, or form in a sentencing proceeding, capital or non-capital. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, this can come in. It's consistent with due process. Our General Assembly enacted statutes along those lines, and they've been interpreted. But they're not a limitation on what a victim can testify to. As the court knows, in a sentencing proceeding, the trial court wants to acquire whatever information it can regarding the defendant so it can craft a sentence.
But at a minimum, the statute does present a protocol for how that's to be accomplished, doesn't it?
For the impact. Impact is different than just normal evidence. It doesn't prohibit the court from taking evidence other than impact evidence. If you're admitting something strictly as impact evidence, then it has to come in under one of the five or six different points. The form itself, which is in the sealed appendix, actually kind of mirrors the statute to a little bit as far as the categories of information that it asks for in that regard. But that's also to allow for the victim, the written form is to allow for the victim to be maintain their privacy to a certain degree. They don't have to come into court and testify, and the court can have access to that. But it's, again, the statutes don't prohibit other information from coming in.
Including all manner of things that may be favorable
yes.
to the defendant.
True.
For example.
Very true. And
pre-sentence reports, all that stuff.
Right. In this particular case, the default aside, I think the subparagraph 6, which you've talked to, also relates to the point that you brought up at the beginning with regarding to foundation. I refer to it as context. To tell a judge that, you know, that on the front door somehow sends you into a panic state or something like that, you have to be able to explain why. And in order for someone to understand why an adult would, you know, basically go into a panic state of some kind or have flashbacks simply because somebody's knocking on the door, you have to understand that somebody kicked down the door, came inside, dragged her around by the head, threw her from room to room, held her child at arm's length, one-year-old child, dropped him on the floor, and threatened to kill people. That has an effect. That causes flashbacks. That causes fear. You have to have that in context. Now, the other part that I don't think makes a lot of sense about the defendant's argument is the defendant said the trial court knows all this. Well, the trial court knows all this, and at best you have cumulative evidence. So I'm not sure that there's any anything that could ever be considered reversible error if the trial court already knows facts and a witness testifies.
His argument was some of that the defendant took issue with, so it's not just cumulative.
Coming from this witness, not the facts themselves. He's saying that they were already before the court. So I'm not sure that you get very far with that argument. First, I think it's admissible. Second, I think it's cumulative at best. Third, you have the other point. This is a trial judge. Trial judges, aren't as concerned about the inflammatory nature of testimony, et cetera, as other people would be. And the other point I would bring up is there's clearly no assertion during the trial proceedings that there was any prejudice outweighing any probative value. That point was never brought up as well. I would note that in this particular case, the defendant did testify at the sentencing hearing. He disputed some of the evidence, but the defendant did admit to almost all of the same conduct. So the defendant, did dispute. I think his dispute was with the woman who was shot at versus he said it was shooting up in the air, and then he accused these people of being drug dealers and stuff. But that's another sign. And one of the things that the trial court specifically noted that was of great concern to it had nothing to do with this victim's testimony. It's the extensive record this defendant had. This defendant had 7 straight years of court supervision, been in and out of prison, had only been out of prison, I think, 6 to 7 months at the time he committed this offense. And he has a clear escalated conduct towards more severe conduct. And the court, I think, rightly decided that, this is someone who needs to be off the streets for a significant period of time. And that doesn't, have anything to do with the specific events in this case. That has to do with his own criminal history, which has nothing to do with the evidence that this lady testified to during the court proceedings. I think there was one other point I wanted to make.
Start talking about the null process. Yeah. We cut you off.
The null process thing, I'm not sure that matters. If that, and I don't want to say that flippantly or anything. In the Harris case, which we cited, the prosecutor was proffering conduct from another trial in which the defendant had been found not guilty. But that was still considered to be okay for sentencing. So I'm not sure that has any weight given the precedent of this court. Although appellant argued the witnesses at his trial were not credible, he did not disagree with the Commonwealth's attorney's representation regarding the substance of their testimony and the other evidence at trial. So if they're just, if you have a prosecutor who's doing that, what's the difference between that and putting a witness on? And available for cross-examination, you bring up every point you want. But as far as sentencing hearings go, again, I just would like to reiterate that these statutes don't limit what a prosecutor can, in fact, put on. Matter of fact, I'm reasonably sure, although it's not part of the appendix, and I came into the case a little bit late, so I didn't have a chance to look at the pre-sentence report. But the pre-sentence report may also have all the same evidence in it, and I'm assuming that's in the record. If the court doesn't have any further questions, Commonwealth would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Just to address several of the points that were made by the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth argues that the judge in this proceeding was entitled to as much information about the defendant as could possibly be obtained, and I would actually agree with that. However, the means by which judges generally obtain that information, as you pointed out a few minutes ago, is through a pre-sentence investigation report. That report usually goes into social background, economic background, criminal history, etc. I don't think that the appropriate place for the judge to garner that information is through the victim's testimony at a sentencing hearing about the conduct of the defendant at the time the event took place. Concerning the argument about victim testimony as to charges that had been nolprost, as was pointed out in the brief, Virginia case law has basically described cases where a defendant pleads guilty and certain charges are to certain charges and other charges are nolprost as a bargain for exchange between the Commonwealth and the defendant. And my argument is that if you allow a victim to then testify to certain facts and circumstances regarding charges that have been nolprost, it violates the spirit of that bargain for exchange. A good example is in a lot of breaking and entering cases, you might see an accompanying grand larceny charge. And a lot of times the Commonwealth might offer, well, if he pleads guilty to the breaking and entering, we'll nolprost the grand larceny. I don't think many defendants would enter into that agreement and accept that deal if they knew that at a sentencing phase down the road, the victim could take the stand and describe the value of all the items that were taken, as an example.
Is the answer to that problem to pin down in the written agreement what is going to be allowed?
Well, my argument would be that the code already does that. I think that by listing those six specific factors to which a victim can testify, I think the statute has already limited the scope of the victim's testimony.
Or victim impact
testimony. Victim impact testimony. That's correct. So I think that problem has already been addressed.
All righty, sir.
All right.
Thank you. We'll come down to Greek Council.
Thank you.